Welcome back to Dose Nation. My name is James Kent, and I'm joined by my co-host, psychedelic community organizer Hilla.
Hi.
And psychedelic enthusiast Ty Miller.
Hey, guys.
How are you all doing this morning?
So good.
Doing well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So polite. You're both
extremely polite
and cordial. Okay, we've been briefed on today's topic, so we know what we're going to be talking about. And one of the things that I find most interesting in the psychedelic community is this effort to bring psychedelic awareness to the mainstream population. So let's start with the big umbrella question. Is mainstreaming psychedelics even a good idea?
No.
Start with Hillary. We're going to come right off the bat and say no.
No, I think it's a bad idea. I've been pretty anti-medicalizing psychedelics. I'm much more interested in making medicine more psychedelic than making psychedelics more medical, mostly by way of capitalism and making money off of things that have been thriving in the underground for a long time. And it's interesting to say that the psychedelic community, like it's one overarching, one big population of people is interested in mainstreaming. I think that there are pockets of communities, mostly in academia or people who have some sort of funding interest or, you know, like what happened with cannabis, entrepreneurs coming in and wanting to basically just make money off of whatever the new thing is to them. Seems like not a good idea to me.
So do you think the whole idea of mainstreaming psychedelics is expanding the market? That's kind of what you're saying, is like capitalist impulses are to take something that works and then try to turn it into a bigger market share.
Yeah, I think that's what we do, at least in this country. Yeah, just there isn't a lot of infrastructure for different ways of doing that, or different ways of introducing new ideas. It's sort of like the way that we introduce new ideas is through money.
Through making it a product.
Yeah.
And selling it to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think the real danger lies in this. It's like converting it into a lifestyle, if you will, right? Like, because you start to see more and more celebrity type figures like Aubrey Marcus, Joe Rogan, obviously. You know, the list is long of people that are taking psychedelics and touting some sort of results from them, right? Now, there may or may not be results, but the problem, or what's problematic about that model in my mind, right, is it's like a beer commercial. Nobody's ever getting a DWI on a beer commercial, not that I'm aware of, right?
I think there were some, but go on.
Okay, or somebody like getting in a stupid fight with their girlfriend over nothing because they're hammered. You don't see that in a beer commercial, right? So it's like with the psychedelics, you're only seeing these pro psychedelic messages, like essentially you're going to take a psychedelic and have some sort of experience that's going to unify you with the universe or whatever, you know? And I just don't think that the proof is in the pudding, if you will. You know, it was Terrence McKenna that said, what did he say? It's an experience not to be missed. You know, it's like, what does he mean by that?
This goes back to what we were talking about in the last episode of people who take psychedelics or people who are enthusiastic about psychedelics. I feel like are constantly trying to convince people who haven't taken them mm-hmm. that they're missing out mm-hmm. on something. Mm-hmm. And the question is this, where does this impulse come from? Is this an earnest impulse of sharing and wanting to bring people into the fold? Or is there something more cynical going on about, I want you to validate this experience for me? I mean, by accepting it as a legitimate experience, as opposed to looking at me as some kind of freak because I take drugs to have unique experiences.
I mean, hell, it hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's about making money at this point, isn't it? I mean, it's got to be. What else? What drives anything in this culture? It's if you can make money. If you can make money off of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are people who have, especially like just folks, like regular people who, you know, have LSD and then for some weeks or months or even a year are still like kind of high afterwards. They're stoked. Like they want to give it to their grandmother. Or they want to give it to the president. Like, they want to put it in the water. It's like, it's, you know,
grandma.
It's effect of the medicine, right? But, and I don't think it's those people who are like trying to get validated or, you know, trying to make money. But I do think that, you know, I have questions about the Johns Hopkins medical psychedelic research fund that it's like so hot right now. Everyone's talking about. I'm wondering about that, you know?
What are you wondering about it?
I'm wondering, like, what are they going, what's going to happen with that? Is it just going to be more medical paradigm, you know? Is it going to be more people taking psychedelics in clinics? Is it going to make it more unsafe for people who it has been relatively safe for in the underground is a main thing. You know, legalization, I think, will make it more unsafe for the underground in general, which is something I think that's being missed.
Why is that?
Because then it is a competing interest for businesses or for capitalistic goals.
So I think I disagree because the real danger at this point in time is there's no regulation. So if you go and buy a product, there's no oversight into what you're actually purchasing, right? Mm-hmm. So the only thing is legalization essentially is a guarantee of purity, if you will. So I'm a huge advocate of legalization, but I don't know how you can separate the legalization from the psychedelic milieu, if you will. Like, I don't know how you can make these things available to people and then extricate the mythology that's developed around them. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys.
Yeah, it seems like that's what's kind of happening, okay, or what's trying to happen.
So this is a good point where we can bring in this first article that I wanted to look at here. Take a look at this Life magazine from May 13th, 1957. Now, this is the magazine where Gordon Wasson published his experience with Maria Sabina. And you have a big color picture here of Maria Sabina doing her mushroom ceremony. And you have Gordon Wasson's description of the ceremony going to the little town in Oaxaca. And it's a fascinating read. But go ahead and flip a few pages back in this magazine and look at what sort of topics and what sort of marketing is going on.
Fashion explosion. Yeah, Ford Motor Company.
Ford Motor Company with different vintages of cars. Yeah. Goodyear.
Uh-huh.
What so else we have here?
Tires.
Life magazine back in the 50s.
Kodak.
This was the internet, essentially. This was your weekly download of what's going on around the world.
A curious companion for a cow.
Yeah, and so we're flipping here through the pages and looking at how delightfully corny these are now, back in the 50s. All of these old fonts, all of these old, what is this, a new Beefaroni?
Yeah, new Beefaroni.
It's an entire two-page spread.
Spread for Beefaroni. Literally 5 pages before we get to the article on magic mushrooms.
Hold, hold on, this Beefaroni though is macaroni with beef and tomato sauce.
So who reads this magazine?
Yeah,
it's middle America, but it's such an interesting analogy that you just made because literally this is pre-internet, so you're absolutely right. This is the internet. You know, we just need an ad blocker.
Okay, so we have this family magazine, which is really a coffee table magazine. It's something that you throw on the coffee table in front of the fireplace. You maybe read a couple articles, you page through it. And in between this stuff about cars and cooking and fashion, you have a story about magic mushrooms giving you strange visions. Now, some people
written by the vice president of J.P. Morgan and Company Incorporated.
Right. Now, a lot of people will tell you that Gordon Wasson was working for the CIA and that J.P. Morgan was a CIA front and Henry Luce, the publisher of Time Magazine, was a Republican affiliated with the CIA. And this was all some coordinated propaganda effort by the CIA to introduce psychedelics to middle America. I'm not sure I believe you can make all the ties. You can make all the ties. You can go back and say, oh yeah, look, you can, and the conspiracy theory maybe holds a little bit of water. But the truth is Henry Luce was a Republican. He was a publisher and he was a psychedelic aficionado. At this point in the 50s, there were a lot of people in New York in Republican circles, conservative circles, who were really into experimenting with psychedelics. So it is a very strange thing that they're trying to slide this in here in the magazine under the auspices of, oh, this is the vice president of J.P. Morgan telling you this story about visionary mushrooms pressed in between ads for Goodyear tires.
Yeah, but the
Beefaroni.
Pre-Reagan conservatives were kind of a different breed of Republicans. They would have been more of what we would define as a classically, a fiscal conservative.
Conservative, social conservative, or but
a little bit. And especially, too, because in there wasn't the psychedelic milieu at the time. It just didn't exist.
Well, it was all academics.
It was all academics.
Right.
And, like, the thing that I found really, the relationship that's most interesting to me is Gordon Wasson went on to hook up with Schultes. And Schultes was a, you know, a hardcore mainstream academic, you know, and Gordon Wasson, and in my mind, absolutely went bananas. I mean, he started seeing psychedelic parallels everywhere he looked, right? I think you pointed out that isn't he like one of the original progenitors of this idea that Soma is the Amanita muscaria?
Yeah, you know, that's just the Wassonian cult is, the Amanita cult of Soma.
Yeah, so it's just like he kind of went off the rails with this. But at the same time, Schultes maintained some level of academia. But I mean, I honestly don't
because
know.
Because he didn't eat the Amanita?
I'm pretty sure he did.
Okay.
Like, so looking at this method of inserting a psychedelic worldview into a mainstream publication, how does this article look? I mean, I'm so blown away every time I flip through this magazine and I get to this article and it's like, well, what the hell is this? There is nothing in this magazine that talks about people in developing countries, indigenous people, anything having to do with people of color, people of other nationalities. And then like in almost the centerfold of this book, you have this highlight talking about this Native woman healer. Mm-hmm. It's almost mind-blowing. It's mm-hmm. almost so out of time. It's hard for me to even, you know, it blows my mind every time I look at it. It's like somebody went back in time and stuck this in the middle of Life magazine. Mm-hmm. The other thing that blows my mind about this is that this is how a whole generation of explorers like Terence McKenna were first introduced to this idea. Mm-hmm. When I interviewed Terence, he said that this was the first inkling that he got, that there was something bigger out there that was more magical that he should check into. Mm-hmm. He was very young at this time. I don't think he was old enough to go to Oaxaca at this time, but he became a world traveler looking for mushrooms and things like that, basically because of this article. It was the progenitor article. One thing I like to talk about when discussing the mainstreaming of psychedelics is the law of unintended consequences. And I don't know what they were trying to do, what Wasson was trying to do, or Henry Luce was trying to do, putting this article in there. But essentially, it turned Oaxaca and Huatla de Jimenez, the little town that Maria Sabina came from, lived in, turned it into a destination spot for hippies. And they, over the course of the next few years, kind of ruined that town through their mushroom tourism. And Maria Sabina was hated in her own village for being a traitor. So, was this a success? I mean, this is a historic thing. I mean, this is like, besides like Doors of Perception, this was the only thing around this magazine article. Was this a success? And how has it tainted the entire way Western civilization sees psychedelics, even up to this point right now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, a success for, it seems like it was a success for Gordon Wasson. It was success for the magazine, success for...
Because they could make money off of it.
Yeah, an entrepreneurial success. I mean, it's very similar to the same that is what's happening now, right? You know, like it's in the middle of magazines and being presented in places online and in the news where folks who would not otherwise be introduced to psychedelic experience, you know, articles for ketamine clinics, articles for microdosing, right?
Right.
Are all out, you know, coming across the news feeds of folks who might not otherwise see them.
So we're definitely in an era of mainstreaming.
Yeah.
Because I feel like back in the 50s and early 60s with the psychological movement, with the CIA's involvement in MKUltra, there was a public awareness that built all the way through the hippie revolution until eventually they became illegal, and there was this whole backlash against them. Now, as when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, there was no mention of psychedelics in media at all, unless there was a Just Say No message or somebody in an after school special jumping out of a window because they were high on PCP or something, right? That was the 70s. That was the 80s model, right? If you're going to show drug use in some sort of mainstream media, it's only the very most negative thing. Mm-hmm. And so when I started publishing Trip Magazine, it wasn't really to mainstream psychedelics because I thought there's no way that mainstream society is ever gonna pay attention to this. It was essentially just for the community. It was just for the people in the community who were already interested in that sort of stuff. And even when we started doing Dose Nation, the blog, there was still very little. I mean, MAPS was publishing a newsletter, and every once in a while, a newspaper would pick up a story related to a MAPS study that was being done. But nobody was publishing any information about psychedelics until about maybe 2005 or 2006, when suddenly there was this medicalization push, like, are psychedelics going to revolutionize psychology? And the mainstreaming came through this psychological movement. And since you're in the therapy field, I'm wondering, do you think that that is a positive way to introduce psychedelics to the mainstream, is through the therapeutic model?
I think it's a positive way for people to access psychedelics. I'm not sold on the idea of mainstreaming psychedelics at all. I don't think that it's for everyone. I don't think that that's the right container for everyone. I do think that there are good containers at parties. I do think that there are good containers at home, you know, by the fireplace with your homies. You know, that's like maybe one of the best containers. But I do think that in the hands of people who study the mind, that is a generally safe container for people to access psychedelic space.
It seems like every once in a while I'll meet a burnout that essentially was talking about how they were involved in some sort of psychological experiment with these things, right? And they took massive doses with this doctor, blah, 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 blah.
It's like, Where did you meet them? At PCC?
Probably. But I want to kind of circle back because we start talking about it in a broad view. I'm starting to form this opinion that just the greater society as a whole, right, they're just not going to be interested. And the only way that my mind can conceptualize this is it's the same thing with like really kinky sex, right? Only a small percentage of people are ever really going to get into like wearing latex or something like this. You know what I mean? And nothing against you people. I'm not trying to come down on you. What I'm trying to say is that like most people, I just think there's just no place in their lives for it. You know, they've got to take their kids to soccer practice. Mm-hmm. They've got to.
I've been contacted by soccer moms who got turned on to LSD and were like, why don't more moms on the playground want to talk about this? And I'm like, don't talk about this with the moms on the playground.
Pass their number along to me. I'm like, I'll talk to them. Like vegans or anything, if you get, or even like Scientologists, you know, a Scientologist gets really excited about Scientology and they want to tell everyone about Scientology. And we're all like, dude, shut the fuck up. Right? It's because we don't care. Right. But they do care. And I'm wondering if this is the thing about psychedelics is ultimately, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to see the tide go back out to where people are going to be like, dude, just shut up. I don't care. You know, I think the three of us find it fascinating. And, you know, we're experienced individuals that have done these things and we wonder what it is. What is this that's happening? Right. But I just don't think that there's. I don't think that there's room in most people's lives to wonder about that.
One of the things that I noticed recently is that country music that has been sort of immune from the influences of psychedelic culture. And just this past month, an artist named Sturgill Simpson released an album, The Sound and the Fury. Do you know The Sound and the Fury?
Introduced me to that guy.
I just wrote down Sturgill Simpson because he wrote the song called Turtles All the Way Down, which is about smoking DMT. And it's a hardcore country and western song.
Yeah, and he just released an hour-long animated video of his album, which is like a cross between Road Warrior and heavy metal.
Did you see it?
Anime, yeah.
I just watched it. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, this we're seeing in real time psychedelic influence crossing over into an entirely new genre and an entirely new community of people.
Well, I can argue that pretty easily because if you look back at outlaw country of the 1960s, 1970s, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, I mean, the chances that they did some drugs is really, really high.
They were all doing lots of drugs, but the drug message never came through in their music, and their music never became like heavy feedback, distortion, delay, blistering guitar solos, like all the stuff that Sturgill Simpson is doing in his quote-unquote country music album sounds to me like classic rock, classic psychedelic rock with a slight country vibe.
Well, I just wanted to add though too, because every once in a while I'll find out that a particular modern country artist has just sold 20 million albums or something like this, and I've never heard of them, so I can't make any claim to be up on pop country culture. I just don't know. Like, I don't care. I can't stand the music, but like,
okay, Ty is making enemies. He's not speaking for everybody. People who wear latex and listen to country music, you know, we love you. Speaking of psychedelics in middle America. Do either of you watch Vice TV?
Absolutely.
So do mm-hmm. you know Kentucky Ayahuasca and yeah. Hamilton Morris and mm-hmm. and all of these shows? We love Hamilton.
I know Hamilton quite well.
I was going to put Hamilton in here as an example of somebody who I think is doing it the correct way. Mm-hmm. Where they're basically just making informational documentaries. So, but what do you think about shows like Kentucky Ayahuasca or this is like Hilla's shaking her head like,
so I think Hilla's too bashful. So I'm just going to say this. Hilla's actually in love with Hamilton Morris.
Uh-oh.
It's true. Oh. He says everything perfectly. How could you not love him? He says everything perfect.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And yeah. we had him on our very early Dose Nation show. And I always enjoy seeing him at conferences and stuff. But you're what about some of the other programming have you seen? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I watched the Kentucky Ayahuasca and I mean they seem like really nice, well intentioned people. It seems like they're having good results. I know someone who went to him and 3 years ago and has had a really extremely positive life changes and has worked with psychedelics since then and continues to have really positive experiences and got a new job and is buying a house and like just sort of feeling good about his life. So that all seems good. It doesn't, you know, there are questions of like, wow, that guy's really not representing the tradition that this medicine comes from.
Do they have any therapeutic background
practice? It sure doesn't look like
it. Or is it just all sort of an ad hoc experiment that they're running?
It sure looks like an experiment. It's like, oh, it looks like it's going well so far, you know, and they're well-intentioned. It is alarming on one level for sure. Yeah.
Live podcast of the Cascadia Psychedelic Conference is going on Town Hall.
What's the dates?
April 10, 11, 12.
And you've got some speakers up on your website at CascadiaPsychedelic.org. I noticed my picture's not up there yet. Am I not speaking?
No, we don't. Yeah.
Should I send you something? Will you put me up?
Yeah, if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to have a
Do you want me to do a presentation besides the podcast or just do the podcast?
Do you want to?
I could.
I think we could probably get you in there, man.
Okay.
I think I could probably talk to some people.
Do you know the organizer?
Yeah. Okay. What do you want to talk about?
Can you put my picture up too?
Yeah, if you
want. I'm just kidding. Why don't you put my picture up?
Because your hair is so good.
That's right. We're planning a live Dose Nation podcast recording at the Cascadia Psychedelic Conference at Town Hall in Seattle on April 10th through 12th, 2020. For more information, visit CascadiaPsychedelic.com. That's CascadiaPsychedelic.com.
Yeah, and even folks who I think, you know, may not be psychedelic inclined even might just think it's interesting or freakish or something fun and kind of wild to talk about at parties, you know, and might not even be interested in trying it.
Well, that's the problem, though. At one point in time, all three of us were that person. You know, like before I ever did it, I was like, yeah, that sounds interesting.
You were the closet bro.
I'm still the closet bro. Now, what I'm trying to say is like the proto psychedelic person is that person that for some reason finds it interesting. If you didn't, you probably never would do it to begin with, right? No one, I don't think anyone ever is like, oh, wow, I've never heard of LSD. I'll take that. You know, it's like, oh, I've heard of LSD. I want that. You know what I mean? Like, it's a subtle difference, but it's significant. Like,
well, how are you exposed for the first time?
Yeah, in Peru.
Oh, so you were actually on a vision.
The first psychedelic you ever did was in Peru.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
It was... And you went there specifically for the experience, or
I was looking for a retreat. I was looking for a yoga retreat, and I had a bunch of vacation stacked up at my university job. And I was like looking for something meaningful to do with my time. I didn't know what ayahuasca was, couldn't pronounce it, wanted to do some traveling, didn't know, I had heard of psychedelics, but didn't really know what they were. Ended up in Peru, checking out Machu Picchu and going to the mountains and high desert, and realized after I drank ayahuasca, oh, this is tripping.
Goddamn right it is.
It all came
together. Goddamn right.
It all came together.
It all came together for you in that one moment.
I was hugging my bucket.
Oh, I'm tripping my face off right now.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it was like. Yeah, so...
And what about you? How old were you when that happened?
26.
Okay, so that's 26. Yeah. That's. Yeah. So how old were you when you were first exposed?
I feel like I was drinking with some friends maybe when I was 17 or 18. Maybe 19 at the latest, and somebody was like, I have some acid, you want some? And I was like, goddamn right I do.
No. Did you know what it was?
I knew that if you took it, you would probably like think you could fly and like you would jump out of a building with wings, blah blah blah, you know, just typical propaganda. But like, that's a joke, by the way. It's just interesting because I was thinking about this just the other day. The guy that gave it to me, or one of the guys that was in the circle, he used to say, like, there's three rules for tripping. The cars are real, fire burns, and you can't fly.
Those are good. Those are just good rules.
Those are good rules. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think I've ever actually used any one of them. You know, it was never like, oh, I wonder if that fire will burn or if that car's real, you know? Mm-hmm. But so I was probably 19, but I would say the first actual real psychedelic experience that I had was on mushrooms when I was probably 21 or 22. And I remember I had bought a bag of them, and like, I didn't know anything about them. So I was like, I'll just take half this bag.
Munch, 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 munch. This tastes awful.
Yeah.
Munch.
Yeah, and just that was about, I think that still may be the highest I've ever been on mushrooms.
But it was a party atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. Undoubtedly. Yeah. Yeah. We were drinking while that was happening for sure. And there was just a couple of us. But what about you?
So I was in college, and a friend of mine came up and said, so-and-so managed to score some acid. We're going to all go up hiking at Big Bear and drop acid for the day. Do you want to come? And I thought, well, sounds like it might be interesting. So I went and actually did some research. I went to the library, and I think I found Plants of the Gods and a Tim Leary book, maybe Exopolitics or something like that. And the one thing that actually, I didn't even read any of the books. I kind of flipped through the pictures, and I remember thinking to myself, this stuff is weird. Mm. Whatever this is, it's weird. Because the stuff in this book is not like, I mean, it's like hieroglyphics is what I'm looking at here. I don't even know what they're talking about. And the other thing that stuck out at me was, like, every other sentence was mysterious, sacred, you know, still a medical mystery, you know, scientists can't explain. And I was like, okay, well, now I'm in. I mean, because if this is a legitimate mystery that science doesn't understand, I need to check this out. Because I was, as a kid, I was always like, I'll solve any mystery, you know, I can just look at it from every angle and I'll figure it out. So yeah, that was my way in, was like, it wasn't necessarily party culture, but it was a recreational thing, like, let's go hiking in the woods. And that was actually a great day.
I mean, that sounds fantastic to
me. Yeah.
And you did your research ahead of time. Yeah. You did the thing that I'm always pushing on people.
I'm such a dork.
That's great.
I have to go look this up in a book, guys.
Yes!
This has been pre-internet. And I told this to some other people. I used to have to, like, drive to libraries to find books. Like, drive, like, sometimes 30 miles to a library to find a book that I could check out. Yeah. Crazy days, kids. We were so crazy back in the day.
Yeah, it's easy to forget, because that's just it. Is I remember like going to a bookstore trying to find a good book to read. Like I
on psychedelics or just any good book?
On any good book.
Yeah.
You know, there was just no Amazon, there was no nothing.
So
just in case anyone was wondering, James actually has authored a book called Psychedelic
That's
Information
right.
Theory. It is available on his website.
It's available at Amazon. You could probably find a free copy of it. Or you know, if you want to throw me some cash, you can buy the hard copy from Amazon.
A book and read it.
Amazon.com. There's pretty pictures in there.
Yeah, that's true.
I have a copy that I bought on Amazon, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only place you can get it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to support this podcast, you could buy a copy of Psychedelic Information Theory on Amazon.com or download a copy of Radio Free Mars, an original science fiction novel by James Kent, available for free on Kindle Unlimited from Amazon.com. Just search for Radio Free Mars or Psychedelic Information Theory by James Kent.
Yeah, I used to haunt bookstores and used bookstores and like always go to like the religion, psychology, mm-hmm, self-help mm-hmm. section.
Oh, yeah.
And there
yeah.
would be like three books on mm-hmm. drugs. There'd be like a book on peyote mm-hmm. or
yes.
who are the spokespeople for the psychedelic movement now?
Well, I mean, it's Michael Pollan, of course.
Michael Pollan, okay.
But see, yeah. but that's another big jump that we've made, because we've gone from Terence McKenna in the 90s and all of these people like on Inner Tradition that are publishing this sort of new age spiritual mysticism perspective of psychedelics. And that's not necessarily mainstream. That's still its own little underground thing.
Undoubtedly.
And it's still going on. They're still publishing those kinds of books. But now you have these mainstream books that are coming out about like Michael Pollan's book, Changing Your Mind.
Well, you know what strikes me is, in my mind, just empirically, I would say that Terence McKenna is probably more popular now than when at the height of his publishing career, right? He's probably more popular now.
I think I blame Joe Rogan for that.
Well let me finish the thought. Because it's like Michael Pollan, is that his name, Michael Pollan?
Yeah.
Pollan.
I think in 20 or 30 years, no one's going to talk about his book. There isn't going to be, because he didn't really come out and say anything new.
It's no, there's more, nothing controversial in there.
Yeah. Whereas in another 20 years, Terence McKenna will still be talked about, still pondered about. And he's such a fascinating, compelling mm-hmm. speaker that he's just fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Michael Pollan, you ain't listen to him for 5-10 minutes. And you're like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And I like him. I read his book. The book, I think, is probably one of the... It's a great historical document because he brings together a lot of disparate narratives that just hadn't been linked before. So I enjoyed reading the book, but it's not fucking transforming machine elves.
You may have heard of microdosing, the practice of taking tiny amounts of psychedelic drugs such as LSD with the hope of gaining some kind of brain boost. People who microdose claim that it makes them more productive, more focused, more creative. But does it actually have any of these effects? Researchers are starting to investigate what, if anything, microdosing actually does by running some of the first placebo-controlled studies on the practice. People who microdose aren't trying to get high. There's no real consensus on what size dose actually counts as a microdose, but most people report taking anywhere between a 20th and a 10th of a full or recreational dose of LSD or other psychedelic drugs, such as magic mushrooms or truffles, which contain the psychedelic compound psilocybin. Taken in such small amounts, these drugs don't have the trippy visual and audio effects you might usually associate with psychedelics.
Whoa.
But some people claim that they have more subtle, even sub-perceptual, beneficial effects. While microdosing is often associated with Silicon Valley productivity hacker types, many in the microdosing community reject this image and say that it's actually about much more than getting ahead in the workplace. And some people microdose in an attempt to self-medicate conditions such as depression, ADHD, or chronic pain, which, by the way, we don't recommend. The problem is, we don't really know what microdosing actually does, or if it does anything at all. And we also don't know if it may have some negative effects, particularly over a prolonged period of time.
Okay, so that's Wired UK, which when I went back and did some research, I realized that a lot of this microdosing stuff came from Wired UK. And in fact, the first article was released on August 24th, 2016. That was the first article that came out. Now, it's funny that this video that they released a few years later says many people in the microdosing community are upset with the fact that this is now related to Silicon Valley upstarts, mm-hmm. where they were the ones that actually promoted that image. Mm-hmm. Do you all remember when this whole microdosing thing started back in 2016? Do you remember seeing these articles?
for sure.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
And what did you think when they first came out?
I guess being surprised that it's being covered, that it's like not psychedelic.
That it's hitting the mainstream news.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That was the surprising thing, is that here we go. It's something is being inserted into the mainstream, and and people are not talking about how it's illegal. Mm-hmm. They're talking about how it might be a productivity boost. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I really started to notice it is as soon as it hit kind of the entrepreneur chain, you know, like when different entrepreneurs were talking about real, you know how they are. They talk really fast. So I started microdosing, blah, 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 blah. Productivity, and now I sell more stuff, you know. And it's just like the whole thing is that it's like, as you pointed out, James, the genesis of it is kind of nebulous. Like, who are these people that are actually microdosing? Do they actually exist? We don't really know. So, okay, I have a confession. I was actually at a beach party, and there was a guy that was really annoying, and he was just talking about microdosing, and he just happened to be an entrepreneur. So all those three things got linked in my mind. And then,
yeah, I mean, I've talked to people just in through the Cascadia psychedelic community, and people, you know, will come, and they're folks who type in the word psychedelic on the internet and then go to a place, a public place where people are meeting to talk about illegal things. And a lot of those people are in tech. And they come because they've heard that, you know, of microdosing, and that there are people at their places of employment where they can get things like microdosing kits and Adderall from their colleagues to make them more productive or creative at work. So they're curious, they want more information.
Who's providing these productivity kits?
Their colleagues.
Oh, their colleagues. Yeah. Just, there's some entrepreneur out there actually delivering microdose kits.
At their places of work, I guess, yeah.
I mean, well, this is the great product, because essentially if there was an effect, that's the wrong dose, right? So here's a kit of doses that we're assuring you aren't going to give you any effects. We're going to charge you a couple $100 for it.
Really incredible is that people are using psilocybin these days in what they call microdosing, taking very small doses and seeing these profound benefits. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm aware of is kickboxers are using it. And kickboxers are using it, and a good buddy of mine is using it, who says that he can see things happen before they happen. Like, it's almost like he's reading people's minds before they're about to do something.
Mm-hmm. Even on microdoses.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
The intense environment of sparring and in the intense physical kinetic interaction of kickboxing, is that he's seeing what people are going to do before they do it in a way that he's never able to do, quote unquote, on the natch.
Right. No, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, and
why aren't you surprised? Like, what do you think is happening?
Because I think
Dennis, what's happening there? But it's funny that we go from Silicon Valley upstarts microdosing to battle stress and long hours to 6 months later, Joe Rogan. Oh, you know what's cool? Kickboxers taking microdoses. This is like watching the trickle down effect in real time. Oh yeah, now it's not just for tech employees, it's for kickboxers. And you know, Joe Rogan is, for better or for worse, he's a very performance-minded person. And the way he's viewing psychedelics in this instance is as a performance-enhancing drug, which is not the way that people ever talk about psychedelics. But I have for a long time thought that they would be very beneficial performance-enhancing drugs for some sports in some small doses,
like hunting or running very fast and chasing an animal that you are going to kill and eat
anything
later.
That requires endurance, I think, would immediately be beneficial if you had a little bit of LSD.
So I think what Hilla was suggesting is that you're propounding the stoned ape theory over there.
No, it's not what I'm suggesting.
In
tribal people for however many hundreds or thousands of years.
It took 2 million years for Australopithecus to go from being in the trees to making crude stone tools. So if they were eating mushrooms that whole time, it was a very, very long wait for them to actually get any benefit.
You're just a hater.
And all of the cows that they were following eating mushrooms, how come they didn't develop language and tools too? They probably ate more mushrooms than any other mammal on the planet. I mean, come on, Terrence, answer that question.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so sorry, we've strayed from the from the Stone Ape. Yeah, I'm down with the Stone Ape.
So it's such an interesting. I mean, I'd never quite thought of that because it is such an interesting idea. Where does this meme, if you want to call it a meme, where does this meme come from that there's a performance enhancement to it? The crux of your question really is, was anyone microdosing before the Wired magazine came out?
I feel like they probably were. I mean, have you ever taken acid or mushrooms and gone to work?
Do I have to answer that? It wasn't a microdose.
So yes. Was it a good idea? Did you have a good time?
I mean, did it benefit my performance? No.
But was it
wasn't a good idea.
It just wasn't a good idea.
So the point, I think that what really needs to be addressed is number one is that one of the premises of microdosing is that you do it consecutive days, right? It's not like, it's one thing, like, you're, to use your parlance, like, to take a halfie and go to work and have a fun afternoon, right?
Sure.
It's another thing to systematically take them over the course of several days with the intended purpose of, like, boosting productivity.
For clarity, do you mean taking them several days in a row?
That's the idea behind microdosing, isn't it?
No.
What's the
because of tolerance builds. Usually the protocol is 1 day on and 2 days off.
1 day on and 2 days off.
And then with the new Paul Stamets stack is 5 days on, 2 days off because of the additional medicinal mushrooms.
So you just said 5 days on, 2 days off.
Yeah, which is a new idea. That's the new microdosing idea since 2017 when Paul Stamets talked about it.
Interesting. I've always been under the impression that you take it multiple days and then you take days off.
It wouldn't so much work because of tolerance building from day to day.
So the first time I heard of microdosing was a friend of mine who used to be a MAPS volunteer. Because he helped organize some of the conferences, there was a dinner with Albert Hoffman back in the 90s before he passed away, of course. And he got to ask Albert Hoffman a couple of questions. Most of what they talked about was gardening, because apparently Albert Hoffman loves to spend time in his garden. They talked about deadheading. Not the Grateful Dead. But flowers. Yeah. And he asked Albert Hoffman, what do you think the future of LSD is? Do you think it'll ever be legalized? And Albert Hoffman said the only way that he thought that he could see it ever being integrated into modern society is if people took it in very small doses for, like, depression. And he thought that there might be a future in LSD as a depression remedy, but only if people took it in very small doses, maybe every day. I don't know if how far the conversation progressed, but when he came back and told me that, I thought, that's never going to happen. And then we cut to 20 years later, I see an article on microdosing for stress and anxiety and depression. And I'm like, okay, well, here's Albert Hoffman's vision finally coming true. And now my question is this microdosing trend like a tailor-made method for wedging the psychedelic experience into a corporatized consumer culture?
I think there's some piece of truth to that. It seems to me more like something that there is something like edgy and forward thinking and we're the future and, you know, about tech people,
sure.
Right? I'm not a tech person, but this is my perspective on them. High tech people. I observe you from afar.
I'm a tech person and I don't take offense. So.
good. Okay. No, I like tech people. They're very smart. That's some way of like introducing something cool and edgy into the workplace, which is something that I think that tech organizations are trying to do to retain people and to keep them working absurdly long hours.
Well, I can tell you in the dot-com boom in the late 90s, there were a couple of companies, I'm not going to name any name, where like taking MDMA at a corporate party on the weekend or even a Friday night party was like a thing that they did to like bond and create the group dynamic.
Any startup of any kind is going to have kind of a party culture associated with it because you can't necessarily be real, like have a wife and a kid and a mortgage and all this stuff and be involved in a startup where you may or may not get paid, you know? So it's probably just attracting younger, more experimental people anyways. Like, I mean, honestly, in most jobs that I ever had, if somebody ever came by and was like, you want to microdose some LSD? I'd be like, yeah. You You know, like the idea of it being...
Give me a kit, man.
The idea of making it more productive. I don't give a fuck if I'm productive or not. Like, why would I be taking LSD?
Right, this was this was my whole take on it. It's like, no one's doing this to be more productive.
Why would they?
This is just something you do to get off at work, right? I mean, not like sexually, but like have a good time.
Yeah, you know, I've had pretty good success taking small amounts of LSD and focusing on. I don't go to work. I haven't gone to work in many years. Yeah, I know. I recommend it. Do whatever you can to not go to work, especially take LSD. but to focus, or like, you know, working on schoolwork, or you know, a project that I need to kind of like hunker down with, I've found it to be as effective as using Adderall. You know, like, oh, I'm excited about what I'm doing, and I can think about it a little bit differently, and it doesn't always work. And I don't know what that is, if my dose is maybe a little bit different, or you know, like if it's me that's different, maybe my sleep or caffeine use. I don't know. You know, more research needed. But I've had good results with it.
So you've had good results, but they're unreliable.
Yes, not predictable.
Not predictable.
Yeah.
Unpredictable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably most people. I mean, that's like I've talked to people who say, yeah, I microdosed before I went out to go do this work. I had a bunch of work to get done in the garage, and then I thought I would be spending the whole day there. And then like 2 hours into it, I was like, oh, I'm too high to be working in the garage.
Yep.
I'm gonna go paint.
Nice.
I mean, I think that. I hate to make statements like this, but the psychedelic experience is antithetical to productivity. I mean, it just, you know what I mean? You're not going to, unless you're like, what is it, Carlos Santana at
yeah,
Woodstock.
Yeah, it depends on what you're doing, right?
I guess it just depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
One of my greatest regrets is that I've never played golf on acid. I think that would be fantastic. Just tripping
well,
balls.
Well, you still got a lot of life ahead of you.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't play golf anymore. I quit golf.
Okay, so psychedelics. So I'm going to agree with your point here. Psychedelics are antithetical to productivity. I think, as a general statement, that one's pretty defensible. I mean, I think you can say that with a high degree of accuracy. So my question is most people, I think, understand that, and yet you have this push to change the topic or change the thinking around psychedelics to associate them with productivity. No, you can be a focused, productive person and still enjoy some LSD.
You know what I think, and this just occurred to me, is like, let's face facts. The microdosing article in UK Wired, it was a very sexy article.
Right.
They produce many
articles. There was like at least a series of three or four articles that they did.
Well, this is just what I'm saying. It's a sexy topic, right? It's like, ooh, that sounds freaking compelling. Like, I'm sure all three of us were intrigued, maybe for different reasons, but all three of us were intrigued by it, right?
I was skeptical when I first saw it. So, but go on.
the point that I'm saying is maybe it's just a meme that got out of control. Like they did it because they knew that everybody was looked at it and was like, oh, that's an interesting topic. This is going to make clicks, right? Mm-hmm. But then it got picked up in the culture as like a positive thing.
Right. And I think the interesting thing about the idea is that psychedelics, people associate them with creative, hippie, flaky type people. But no, now there's a new kind of psychedelic user. That's a young, fresh-faced go-getter that's going to show up for work and work extra long hours and be a little bit more creative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like that's the whole exciting thing. It's the juxtaposition between the previous idea of what a person who used psychedelics is like versus this new tech model.
Do you think you could write an article to our HR department?
Mandatory microdosing.
Yeah, I think it's more of a reflection on tech than it is about psychedelic culture. Because microdosing isn't psychedelic. It's sub-perceptual. It's not psychedelic. You might feel a little bit sparkly, and then it's not microdosing because you're
perceiving it.
Yeah,
so this is my thing. It's like, are sub-perceptual effects actually effects?
There is. I wish that I've familiarized myself with it already, but there's there is this whole like research. Have you seen it about the placebo effect and like is microdosing even doing anything? And you know,
there has actually been some studies, but they're inconclusive. Yeah. They're mostly saying that it doesn't appear to be doing much.
Right.
Well, it's like the milieu of the tech culture also expounds this idea that if you have an iPhone, you're creative.
I have an iPhone.
But do people ever think through the things that they're promoting? I mean, do they ever think about the consequences of promoting microdoses and what could happen to these people on the back end of whatever experiment they're doing because it sounds cool and fun in the moment? And I also think people are kind of greedy for consumer experiences. Like, oh, there's an experience out there that I need to try, like FOMO, right? They're not mm-hmm. gonna, they don't mm-hmm. want to be missing out on something that's cool that other people are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think too, the other thing that really needs to be discussed, because there is no regulation on LSD. It's a what class one substance or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like this idea of microdosing. Like to actually get 10 micrograms or whatever, a sub-threshold amount, you literally have to be a chemist.
I'm so glad that you brought this up again. That's one of the things that I mean, it's a great idea for legalization to be able to have access to clean, predictable drugs. But that is also one of the things I like about it not being regulated is that it puts it on you. Like you have to do your own research. You should buy a test kit and learn how to use it. Be a chemist. Be a scientist. Get a scale, figure out what you're doing.
This is a good question. I mean, can you really responsibly advocate microdosing when accurately measuring microdoses is completely problematic? I mean, there's maybe no way to accurately measure a microdose of LSD, and we'll get into that. And
yeah, not in your kitchen, you know, like you have to really know what you're doing.
The average consumer has no way to measure a microdose.
So the point then naturally leads into, like, most people that think that they're microdosing LSD actually aren't.
Right.
So it's like
they're just dosing.
They're just dosing. And not only that, they're doing variable doses. So it's like maybe one day you have a real productive day because you're high as fuck.
That's the name of my band, by the way. All right, we're going to be back with listener feedback right after this short break.
Although we offer advice on this show, we are not therapists. The advice we offer is based solely on our personal experience and for entertainment value only. If you've had a difficult psychedelic experience and need help with recovery, you can start by looking for a therapist in your area at integration.maps.org. If you need help finding a therapist or a psychedelic support group in your area or want to share your psychedelic experience with us, feel free to reach out at contact@dosenation.com. That's contact@dosenation.com.
So many beverages. So little time.
I think it's the cans. It's like...
He's like... Dirty out of the can.
Like popping. Yeah.
That sound used to make me jump.
The can popping?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of beer drinkers.
I know, I do it at an AA meeting as loud as I can, and like half the people.
Yeah.
Okay, welcome back to Dose Nation. I am James Kent, and I am here with Hilla and Ty Miller. And we are going to do a little listener feedback. And this email came to me from a person who microdosed at work with LSD. And I'll just go ahead and read the letter, and we can talk a little bit about it as we go. Okay. Hello. I'm writing this hoping to reach out to James Kent. I first listened to an interview on YouTube about the dark side of psychedelics, and then I checked out the podcasts on Dose Nation. They really resonated with my experience, and I wanted to reach out in hopes to correspond and maybe get some advice. About a year and a half ago, I think I had what would probably be described as a horror trip, and I've kept going back to that experience over and over. So before this trip, I actually had two positive experiences with psilocybin mushrooms. Both were in the wilderness, surrounded by a few friends and my brother. One of the experiences was extremely intense. I went through a period when I thought I was dying and I forgot all of my memories and what some people describe as ego death. Even though it was intense and I was really raw afterwards, I felt free from the idea of myself, and it helped me with anxiety and depression. In a way, the experience gave me a new perspective on life and a do-over kind of mentality. Now I'm going to step away from the letter. Do you guys recognize those sorts of experiences?
Yes.
The ego death experiences. I was free from the idea of myself. Gave me a new perspective.
That's the new psychedelic commercial.
A do-over.
Yeah.
Well, isn't
a rebirth. I mean, those are all, I mean, good things, mm-hmm. I think, mostly.
Well, isn't it interesting, too, that he uses this term horror trip, which if I'm not mistaken, that's Albert Hoffman's mm-hmm. thing.
Well, yeah, he's talking specifically about an episode I did mm-hmm. called Horror Trips.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And he wrote in to talk about this horror trip, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
After that, I started a new job. It had been a while since I had had a psychedelic experience, and some of the benefits I felt from psychedelics, like getting better habits, etc., started to wear off. I was kind of struggling and wanted a glimpse of that world that helped me understand myself more. Eventually, I was able to get some LSD. Since I had already started experimenting with psychedelics, I would look at sites about psychedelic stuff, and those articles about microdosing would pop up. I had heard about microdosing for about a year at this point and felt the urge to try it with the LSD. There was no specific reason why I decided to do it that day. I remember getting the LSD and knew I had to work for the following few days, so I knew I couldn't have a full trip. I've dealt with mild depression, and I had a pedestrian understanding that LSD and psilocybin act on the serotonin receptors. I do remember reading an article mentioning how microdosing can almost be like an antidepressant. So really, I was eager to have a little, and I wanted to see what the benefits would be during a work day. I don't think I bought the LSD to microdose, but the idea came to mind right before I tried it. So here's where we get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Being impulsive and taking psychedelic drugs.
Well, I mean, I don't...
That can cause trouble.
Depressed, impulsive, going off of, you know, where do you read how microdosing can almost be like an antidepressant, since there's really been no studies done on right, this. Yeah. I mean, this is somebody's speculation that, mm-hmm. that they were reading. So here we go. This is the problem that we were talking about earlier. This is the paragraph that really kind of sticks out to me. The LSD was on a Sour Patch Kid. I asked the guy I got it from if he knew how much was on each dose, but he didn't know. I initially thought about trying to dilute the Sour Patch Kid, but thought it would be the same if I just cut it evenly with a knife. I believe I cut the Sour Patch Kid into eighths to the best of my ability and took 1/8 in the morning. Obviously, I was really rash and not scientific about it. My experience up till then was with mushrooms, and I didn't comprehend how powerful just a tiny amount of LSD could be. But supposedly, if it was 1/8 of a typical dose, I think it would have been within the microdose level. I know it's impossible to perfectly put a dose on candy, though, so I'm not sure. Does this sound like a responsible way to go about microdosing?
No.
Hella has got a very sad look on her face.
I'm sad because this person says that they have been looking at websites and researching psychedelic stuff, and they don't know what microdose means, because they're saying an eighth of a dose should fall in the microdose level, which it doesn't. That's not what microdose means. And
well,
that
continue.
And that diluting a Sour Patch Kid would be the same part as cutting it up, which if we think about what putting a drop on a piece of candy might be like, it's not the same thing as diluting. So I just feel a little bit sad that I feel sad that this happened. I feel sad that this person was not thorough in their research or experimentation with themselves.
Okay, so in all of the articles out there on microdosing, does anybody actually provide a dose range that is considered microdosing?
Yes.
People
between, do. Yeah, between, just, you know, like that video that we listened to, that between a 20th and a 10th.
Of a normal dose.
Of a psychedelic
well,
dose.
What's a normal dose?
I don't know, 150 to 200.
A perceptual psychedelic dose.
Right.
Yeah.
Was that,
so we're talking about 20 micrograms for, okay. So I don't think that most people who don't really know chemistry or weight understand how small a microgram mm-hmm. is. It's like mm-hmm. one millionth of a gram, I think. So, I mean, it's a super, super tiny amount. This person was not taking a microdose. Mm-hmm. They were Clearly. Just taking a small dose. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may have taken the full dose, because if they divided up...
Right.
If they got the piece up, that had yeah, the dot on right. it.
Boom.
Yeah. 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 Long story short, I was in a decent trip at my job.
always the best start of a good story right there.
I was in control enough where I carried on throughout the day, but it took a toll. I remember being paranoid that the people knew I was on something, even though I'd be the last person people would predict. For my job, I deal with talking on the phone, and I just remember being weirded out by the sound of people's voices coming through the phone line as I was talking to them. Okay, does this sound familiar?
This classic.
This classic alienation paranoia. And yeah. Detachment. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someone talking
that's
on the
weird.
Phone.
Yeah.
Who is this person? Mm-hmm. What the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, in the previous experiences, although they were very difficult, I felt that oneness and the positive parts of the psychedelic experience. But this experience was a nightmare. It was everything I had heard growing up to avoid about drugs, all of the negatives with none of the positives. For some reason, I was afraid to just get up and leave, and I stuck with it the entire day. Towards the end of the day, as my brain was probably reaching its limits, I would see my coworkers talking in the near distance, and just being out of earshot, I felt like I was imagining them talking about me and laughing. How's anybody had this experience?
Yeah.
I know
yeah.
I have this experience all the time when I'm on LSD in public and I hear somebody laughing or talking out of the corner of my eye. I immediately assume they're talking about me, even though I know that they're not. I just feel like they are.
Mm-hmm. I want everyone to know that they actually are.
We are talking about you all the
so
time.
So what LSD does We're is it makes people you. Talk about you.
We're talking about you right now.
It makes you paranoid. Aww. Yeah.
So I would say lesson learned. Number one, if you accidentally or intentionally find yourself tripping balls at work, you should probably tell your boss that you're not feeling well and go home.
Right. That would be the correct thing to do.
Obviously, they said that they were feeling anxious about doing that. Mm-hmm. And like, but that would have been the correct thing to do. I mean, and then go home and put some good tunes on.
Yeah.
It was extremely scary in the moment. Mm. I felt like I couldn't trust my brain and that it was all out of whack. Of course, I had heard about set and setting, but I was naive to think that with my past experiences that I could withstand anything. Now, how does that ring? I feel like I felt that way in the past. Like, oh, I've done this stuff enough. I know what to do. I can take this and go mm-hmm. to the drag races and it'll be fine.
It's set and setting is important, you know?
Right?
It's just
but
important.
you've never been so cavalier about it that you thought, oh sure, I can take this. I've had plenty of trips before. This will be nothing.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, I've done things that I probably shouldn't.
Come
have.
On, fess up. No, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I think you've probably done that.
You know, and it's. I laugh about it pretty regularly, but it's like, you know, if you think you know, then you're probably going to get your ass handed to you. I'm like, oh yeah, I can hang with this. I love psychedelics. Yeah. Yes, give me the maximum amount.
I mean, isn't that though? I mean,
oops.
In some sick way, that's kind of the fun part about it. You know?
It's like dealing with the unexpected.
Well, you just all of a sudden in your situation, you're like, I can't believe I'm in this situation again. But you know you can't recommend that to anyone right. Because it's like clearly as we progress through this letter we'll find out that this gentleman had fairly serious repercussions. Mm.
Okay, so going back to the letter, I'm now going through a lot of what you describe in the podcast, like guilt and anger that I did it to myself and I was naive. Even over a year later, I am generally a little more paranoid in social situations and experience more anxiety and depression than ever before. I also believed what people said about there being no bad trips, in quotes. So that even when I was freaked out during my horror trip, I also felt like I could withstand it and learn something from the experience. I felt anxiety and fear on trips before, but this was on a different level.
Yeah, I think that, I mean... This shouldn't be a surprise at this point, but I've found psychedelics to be remarkably healing. And one thing that I have a big problem with in the sort of psychedelic marketing of the healing aspect is that there are no bad experiences, because there are traumatic experiences.
Right. That's we every time I read one of these letters, we're going to hit a talking point. We're going to hit a community talking point. Last week it was one session with ayahuasca is worth 10 years of therapy, which is some bullshit talking point that somebody came up with back in the 60s, probably. And so this week's talking point is there is no bad trips. And I just have to completely disagree with that. Yeah. But I feel like people who are novices or people who are just getting involved, they really believe this. And I actually see this online when people come in and say, oh, I had a really hard experience on this and this and that. One of the first responses will always be, there's no bad trips. You have to learn and integrate and then jump right back in, right? And do it again to help reverse whatever it is that happened during that trip.
A difficult experience is not the same thing as a traumatic experience either. It's like, I've had lots of difficult experiences that I've learned a lot from. And I think that is like, that's what the message is about. But it's not being traumatized, being afraid to leave work because you accidentally dosed yourself and now you're afraid everyone's talking about you. Like, that's traumatic. That's not good.
That's a great point. I mean, there's a difference between a difficult trip where you have to wrestle with yourself a little bit, and something that's traumatic where you're just feeling high anxiety panic and you can't escape.
Yeah. So I disagree. Shocking. I don't.
Tyler's trauma.
I think that there are no bad trips. There's only bad people. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Like, I mean, so let's break this down. I mean, of course there's, I mean, this guy was just a victim of circumstance. Mm. Like he fucked up is what happened.
Well, right. And then that's, I think a part of the problem here is that they realize they fucked up and now they're feeling guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. And where do you go after that? You say, I fucked up. I've got some post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. How do I deal with that? Mm-hmm. He's writing to strangers on the internet.
I mean, I would think he would go to therapy.
Well,
I fucked up. I'm feeling stress and anxiety. So I feel traumatized.
Let me just finish out this part of the letter. I'm grateful that you are putting the information out there because it is important to see both sides of things. Before I had this horrible experience, I would have been one of the people preaching about all the benefits and insights I've gotten from psychedelics without ever mentioning the potential downsides. Any help or advice would be appreciated.
Well, let's point out then real quickly that this was beneficial because now he's not going to.
Well, how about what cost though? There's the risk reward. Okay, so
hold on though, like where does he go to talk about this? Obviously he goes to a therapist or something like this, right?
Well, this person had not been in therapy.
I guess it wasn't obvious to
until I advised, is what I do to most people who write me. The first thing I tell them is like, listen, I'm not a therapist. I'm just a stranger on the internet and you shouldn't trust anything that I say. What you should do is find a therapist in your area that you can talk this over with. And all I can tell you is that this happens to a lot of people and you're not alone. I mean, that's basically most of what I can do other than engage them in casual conversation, which also does sometimes help.
Well, we can point out real quick too, if you do a Google search, I believe you can find therapists that specialize in integration therapy.
Oh yeah, MAPS now has. So when I first started doing this dark side, it was very hard to find resources online. 6 months, 7 months, 8 months after I started doing these the dark side episodes, MAPS had a page up on their site for finding people in your area who can help you with these things. And that was, I'm not going to say it was all me who did that, but there's also...
Thanks, James Kent.
There's also Ingmar Gorman. Ingmar Gorman contacted me very early on saying, hey, I've recently learned that this is a problem. I've recently been contacted by people who have PTSD-like symptoms after taking ayahuasca or other specific drugs. And I'd be really interested to hear about the people that are contacting you. So I started funneling people to him. He's got a website called psychedelicprogram.org. where they talk about therapeutic integration and ways of dealing with difficult experiences. And then shortly after that, MAPS had this resource list that they now have. And there's also the Zendo Project, although they're mostly about live events. And they do some peer-to-peer counseling. But it's not a therapeutic setting. It's a peer-to-peer setting.
Sure, yeah.
So too, let's add, I think it'd be important to add, if this gentleman is listening now, you're not alone.
Right.
Like, I would imagine that something similar has happened to the three of us. I know... Mm-hmm. When I when I, the first time that I really, really broke through on DMT, I was, I mean, for the next 45 minutes to an hour, I was terrified.
Yeah, devastated is just, usually what happens.
Just like, I was like, literally, what have I done? Like, right. on an, at an existential level, you know? So it's like, I think that it's important to know that, that these things do and can happen, can and do happen, you know?
Yeah, it's a real shame that we don't talk about this more. I think that talking about, you know, we say culturally in psychedelic culture, we're always sort of redirecting to difficult experience, there are no bad trips. But I think we should be saying difficult or traumatic experiences because they happen. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are expecting, you know, I'm going to take MDMA one time and my PTSD will be gone, or, you know, I'll find someone to sell me psilocybin and I'll talk to God, I'll have an ego death, it will be beautiful.
Right, and then, they want the magic bullet.
Yes, yeah, of course.
But they get
course.
The shotgun.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so the person, when they wrote this to me, it had been a year. Right. Since they had this initial experience and they were still obsessively dwelling on it. They were obsessively going back to this experience because they felt extreme fear and shame, not fear and shame, self-anger and shame. And the other thing that they mentioned to me over and over again was that because they had this psychotic episode, they felt like they couldn't trust their own judgment anymore.
Yeah.
They felt like something in their brain had betrayed them or let them down. To the point where they were now scared to trust their own judgment. And we hashed this out a little bit. And here's a 6-month follow-up I got from the person after recommending they see therapy. I've been working on my anxiety and depression with a therapist and gaining perspective and understanding for what happened to me. I definitely still have my days where I feel down, but it's mostly when I'm thinking about the old me and how much the bad experiences changed certain aspects of my personality. I kind of know the answer is that this kind of experience truly changes you and you have to move forward and build a new normal. But I just wanted to reach out and see if you ever experienced that feeling of wanting to get your old self back. I know when you experience something where you lose your trust in your perceptions, it changes you. So have you ever had a psychedelic experience that you came out of the other side and thought, oh, I've changed myself now permanently?
Yeah.
You're shaking your head.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And I can never go back to the old me now.
Just that those parts are dead or fallen away or gone, or
you've released them,
or they were clawed away.
So you're talking,
is actually what I'm
so
thinking
you're
of.
Talking about like a therapeutic or a healing thing where I've let these old traumas go, or I've let this old part of myself go because it's no longer helping me.
Not from an experience like he's describing,
where
not
you
from
come,
a traumatic
you come
experience.
Out on the other side, feeling like something is missing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, what this reminded me of a lot, feeling like wanting your old self back and lose trust in your perceptions, it changes you, was I've had multiple traumatic brain injuries. And that's what this reminded me of, is like, oh, I wish I could be whole again. I wish I could get myself back. I wish I could be my old me. I don't trust my brain anymore.
How did you get traumatic brain injuries?
From car accidents.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of drinking and driving.
Jesus.
Sorry.
Not me.
Sorry. I always go to the dark comedy.
It wasn't my fault.
I can't help myself.
She's actually a running back in the lingerie football
league. Yeah, you didn't tell us you had CTE, Hilla. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Giving you some more softball questions.
Jeez.
You didn't notice my helmet?
So I'll just... If I can chime in to follow up there, I have never, not on psychedelics anyway, I've never had an experience where I came away, because this is what he's saying is major. And I think that, I think what Hilla just equated it to is more accurate.
Right. Like a head trauma. I mean?
Like a head trauma, because I've had fucking really bad trips, but I never was like, God, I wish I was the same person I was yesterday that I am today. That's never happened to me.
I feel like there was a sense of maybe pre this microdose failure, there might have been more of a cavalier or a happy-go-lucky attitude that this person had. Is like, I can take on anything.
Yeah.
And now in the wake of this experience where they got their ass kicked, basically. And when you read the letter, it doesn't sound like much happened to them. They were sitting at work and things seemed weird and people were talking out of the corner of the ear, and they felt, But it's like being in a boiler, right, for the whole day, like the frog boiling in the pot, sitting there in your at your desk all day trying to hold it together.
Well, let's face facts. Like, no one here is under the impression that they actually microdosed. They obviously...
Right. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
So it's like, if they had... The real question, the million-dollar question is if this person had been like, I'm going to eat a fucking bunch of acid and go to work today, right? If he'd approached it that way, as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to get a little beneficial hit and like be more productive at work today.
Right.
It's just two different mindsets.
I'm going to take a hit to help me with my depression before I go to work today.
Mm-hmm.
Is maybe not the best set and setting.
No. Yeah.
Well, no, you shouldn't do drugs at work. Come on.
not maybe a whole hit.
You're saying you should have taken a placebo.
I don't know. You know, I am probably more atheist than agnostic on the microdosing argument at this point in time. I don't necessarily think that it does boost creativity. I mean, obviously research needs to be done that hasn't been done. But to kind of tie it all together, where did he get the idea that eating some of this gummy bear or whatever it was going to help him at work? You know?
Well, it's the blogs, the microdosing articles he was reading. That told him that it was an antidepressant to microdose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he was following instructions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like he got the idea from nowhere. And this is, I actually went back and we had a little bit of a lengthy discussion about, well, where did you get this idea? And he was like, oh, yeah, I had been reading about it a lot on the internet before I tried it. And I'm just saying, this is like the unintended consequence. When you say, hey, people go try microdosing, they don't know how.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
nobody knows how to accurately microdose unless there's somebody, like you say, someone who's got like a chemistry set and some pipettes that they can actually sit there and measure out little microdosed solutions.
Yeah. That's...
And I know a couple people like that, but I'm not even like that. I mean, I'm just too clumsy and inattentive to do like stuff that's that finely detailed. Like I have to measure 20 micrograms of something. No, it's not going
to
work.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say you have to be a chemist to make that work.
You have to have at least some chemical knowledge.
You need to be very careful.
You need to follow a recipe. You need to follow a recipe at least of some kind.
I wouldn't try it because I would fuck it up.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. So I would fuck it up.
Let me finish out this letter here. Mm-hmm. In your experience or the people you've talked to, do you have any tips for feeling like yourself again? I also wanted to get any feedback on feeling not as cognitively sharp as before. It still hits me at times during the day that I lost it, and I experience a disconnection from my environment that is unpleasant. I know part of it is rooted in the PTSD and anxiety, but sometimes I worry that I might be like this for a while. Does that get better with time and I have to wait it out? Okay, so 2 years after the fact, I checked back in with them, and they're doing better. Their anxiety is under control. Their obsessive ideation is under control. They're managing anxiety with CBD. They're no longer in therapy, although they're thinking of having a checkup.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm going to say as someone who has done a lot of research and had the experience and been around for a while, when people do have experiences like this and there is some post-traumatic stress disorder related to a trip, it does usually get better, but sometimes it takes 6 months to 2 years. To get better. And that's like a realistic time frame, just from the people that I've talked to and following up with people. 6 months later, it's still raw. A year later, it can still be pretty raw. 18 months later, it's starting to feel like something that was in the past. And then 2 years later, it's starting to feel like finally I can move on from this. Now, I don't think that there's a lot of people in the psychedelic community that know that you can have a trip that will take you a year or two to recover from. Is that anything that anybody ever discusses?
Well, I mean, I think it's not an attractive thing to talk about, right? It's scary, right? Even our friend here is like, you know, I feel shamed. Like, this isn't, you know, I was one of those people who's saying, oh, this has helped me so much with my depression and anxiety and like, you know, feeling connected and all that. So it's not like a hot thing to talk about. But I think that's also because there isn't enough crossover with psychedelic community and information and psychological information. You know, like when I hear this, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, this person has been really traumatized. Doesn't feel as cognitively sharp.
Right.
You know, like I can recognize that as a brain issue, but that's also trauma. You know, there's like just this cloud that's hanging over you. So yeah, it's just not something that is talked about because we're sort of being sold this idea that we take this medicine and then it fixes us, but certainly not at work. with an unpredictable amount, a dose, and that we don't actually even know that it's LSD even, right?
That's true.
So there's no message about him testing it.
It could have been 25i or something like that that, you know, mimics LSD, right, but is actually way more traumatic.
Well, and let's talk too real quickly about the elephant in the room is he mentions pre-existing conditions. You know, he was depressed to begin with.
Sure. And that's something that we talked about a lot in some follow-up emails is like, how much of this is pre-existing and how much do you think is actually a result? And there were pre-existing conditions, but they became like forefront after this. Mm-hmm.
Like exacerbated.
They became exacerbated, exactly.
Which is certainly what happens when psychedelic drugs are eaten.
Just as a PSA, is that a public service announcement? If you have symptoms, psychological symptoms, before you take any sort of psychedelic, just keep in mind that those symptoms may be amplified.
Yes,
and
all up in your face.
But that's not the message. The message is if you have depression and anxiety, this will help.
Yeah. Then I think this is like a major point is that we can't take the context away from that message. The context of the message, which is, you know, you take the drug, you'll get the healing, comes in a very specific package. It comes in the Johns Hopkins package of we're evaluating you with these one man, one woman therapist, and you're going to do these many sessions. Then you're going to take this drug this many times. You're going to do this many integration. It comes in this box. So if you're not working very hard, very, very hard to maintain that with integration, you're not going to get the result that you're being sold. So people are taking drugs at work now expecting to get the Johns Hopkins box, but they're not doing that. So you can't keep that result with the same.
And we're going back to the notion that this is unregulated. Mm-hmm. People hear through the grapevine, through blogs, through podcasts, whatever, that this is beneficial and healing and it does work for anxiety and depression. They don't hear this nuanced argument about context. Mm-hmm. They hear, oh, this is what people are doing. This is what highly productive, intelligent people are doing mm-hmm. to manage their lives, to manage their busy lives. I feel like this person was sold a bill of goods. They had tried psychedelics, and they're like, hey, they work. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling, like you said, if this guy just ate the whole Sour Patch Kid, skipped work, and went to the park for the afternoon, probably would have had a great day. But was told microdoses are effective at treating depression. Mm-hmm. And had that in the back of their mind. I'm feeling a little depressed today. I'm going to try this microdose. And I don't know that that's a great message.
No. Well, that's obviously a poor message. Yeah.
But that's the one that's out there. Hey, kickboxers are doing it to see the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Yes.
Yeah, there needs to be more.
Wow, kickboxers can see the future. I got to try that.
Well, unless your job is a kickboxer, you may not be able to see the future.
I think my point is if you took a macro dose, you'd be able to see further into the future.
For sure. But like maybe all the way to the end of time, though. You have to get the dose just right. Otherwise,
it's
you
go all
the way. Yeah, the escalaton. Yeah. Escalaton. You call it the escalaton. I like.
Yeah.
Thank you to Hilla and Ty Miller for the stimulating discussion. It was great as always. We will see you again next week. And that is another episode of Dose Nation.